So let's begin with our motivation. So 1 year ago, we were welcoming in 2017. And now we're at a retreat, concluding 2017 and welcoming 2018. So it's a good time to reflect on impermanence, and especially the coarse kind of impermanence that we can see when people die and things break in front of our eyes. And somehow between last New Year's Day and this coming one, we've managed to maintain our precious human life, which gives us all the opportunities to practice the Dharma that we could ever wish for. So it's a good time to reflect on how we've used the last year, if we've taken advantage of this opportunity, if we've frittered it away in one instance or another. And then reflect on our actions, the virtue and non-virtue we've created over the year. And in that way, regret the things that need to be corrected and make determinations and aspirations for the upcoming year in terms of abandoning those negativities and creating constructive actions. So one of the best supports to this kind of process is having the bodhicitta mind, the mind that aspires for full awakening in order to benefit all living beings very effectively. Because with this mind, because it's so vast and concerned with the highest welfare of each and every living being, then generating it and doing actions under its influence is a strong purification and a strong creation of merit. And so let's generate that loving and compassionate thought, aspiring for full awakening. Even if it seems a long way off, it's still beneficial to have that aspiration. And may it be our aspiration for sharing the Dharma tonight and this whole weekend, and our aspiration for the rest of our lives, actually. Okay, so about concentration. So we've already in this, the last few talks, we've talked about the objects of meditation, and we've talked about the five hindrances. And so tonight, the five hindrances are discussed by all the Buddhist traditions. So they are sensual desire, malice, lethargy, and drowsiness. Okay, restlessness or agitation and remorse, and then afflictive doubt. But in the in Maitreya and Asanga's books, they had a different list of faults for meditation. So they also, their list is also five, and it has eight antidotes. So those, this is what we're going to talk about tonight. Okay, so this is found in Maitreya's text, Discrimination of the Middle Way and the Extremes. Usually it's just the middle and the extremes. Well, anyway, so the five faults are laziness, forgetting the instruction, which means forgetting your object of meditation, agitation and laxity. So those are two, but they're put together as one, which I'll explain why in a minute. The fourth one is non-application of the antidote, and the fifth one is over-application of the antidote. And so these have, like I said, there's eight antidotes. The first one of laziness has four antidotes, and the other ones all have one. So I'm just going to list these, you know, and then we'll go into talking about each one. So the antidotes to laziness, yeah, so first one is having confidence in the benefit of developing serenity, aspiration to develop it, effort to do so, and then pliancy, which is the actual remedy. And I'll explain what these mean. The antidote to forgetting the instruction or forgetting the object of meditation is mindfulness. The antidote to agitation and laxity is introspective awareness. The antidote to non-application of the antidote is application of the antidote. And the antidote to over-application of the antidote is to chill out. In other words, equanimity, okay? So let's go through these a little bit more. So the first one, laziness, this is the first hindrance. So this is the first hindrance that comes up for us because we can't get ourselves to the meditation cushion to develop concentration to start with. If you can't get yourself to the cushion, you're not going to develop concentration. Because unlike, you know, the exposition of Time magazine, motorcycle repair, painting, you know, working on your computer, golf, okay? These are not activities that generate meditative concentration, okay? So meditative concentration, you have to be on your with your tush on the cush, okay? And so laziness, there's three kinds of laziness, and they all function to not get us there. So the first kind of laziness is sleeping and lying around, okay? That's what we commonly in English call laziness, yeah? The second one is being, as one of my teachers put it, the busiest of the busy, okay? It's called, in contemporary terms, having a life. Yeah. If you aren't the busiest of the busy, if you have one moment of empty time, then you are not popular, yeah? And your life is a total disaster. So we keep ourselves incredibly busy, running around here and there and doing this and that, okay? But most of what we're doing, it has nothing to do with our spiritual development. And in fact, often just puts more obstacles on our mind. Okay, because we create a lot of negative karma. So that's the second type of laziness. So the third kind is discouragement, putting ourselves down, telling ourselves we can't do it. Okay, when you look at those three kinds of laziness, which one, just think for a minute, which one afflicts you the most? Which one is the biggest one for you? Okay, so who has the biggest problem with lying around and sleeping a lot? Okay, who has the biggest problem with being super busy, running around. Oh, okay. Who has a problem with discouragement? Okay. Yeah. So these are all difficulties that we share. Okay. But there are antidotes to them, thank goodness. Okay. Because none of these things are in the inherent nature of our mind. They all have remedies. So our job is to learn the remedies and apply them. Okay. So the actual antidote to laziness is mental pliancy, okay, which is a mental factor that makes the body and mind very serviceable, very flexible, so that you can easily meditate. But since that one is going to take us a while to develop in our practice, we have to start out at thing with the antidotes that are a little bit easier that will actually lead us to developing pliancy. So here the first one is confidence. So this is a joyous state of mind that takes pleasure in meditation. Okay, so it has confidence in the method to develop serenity. It has confidence that if we follow that method, we'll be able to deepen our concentration. And so from this first antidote of confidence comes the second one, which is aspiration. So it's like, I'm confident the method works and I can do it, so now I aspire to do it. Okay. So we're not at the cushion yet. Yeah, we're aspiring. Yeah. So what's going to get us to the cushion? Effort. Okay. So effort is the third antidote. Yeah. So we got to get up, walk over, sit down, and stay down. Okay. And not sit down and then think of 10 things that we must do, otherwise the world is going to end. Okay? You know how that is? You just sit down and then, oh, I forgot, maybe I didn't turn off the stove. Yeah, and you got to go check that. And then, oh, I better check my phone and see, you know, like maybe there's an interesting message after 5 years. And, you know, then I got to do this and I got to do that. Okay. So it's hard for us to get on the cushion and stay on the cushion. Okay. And then once we start meditating, then slowly we, as we apply the antidotes to the following interfering factors, then we're slowly able to develop pliancy as well, okay, which I'll talk about in a minute. Okay, so this thing of confidence to aspiration to effort, it's kind of like when you hear an advertisement about a product. It sounds really good and you believe the advertisement. Sometimes we shouldn't, but the advertisement for concentration is a good one. Okay. So you believe it, then you aspire to get that object, then you make effort to go and get it. Okay. So it's kind of like that. Then we really engage in the practice and we go through 9 stages of sustained attention before we actually get to serenity. Okay, then the second thing, once we got ourselves on the cushion, what happens? Yeah, well, you know, after adjusting our cushion for 10 minutes and changing cushions and scratching and stretching our legs and doing everything but lowering our eyes and sitting still, finally we get to that point of sitting still. Okay, you know that? And then, you know, we're, you know, we've already selected an object of meditation. So I'll use as an example the visualized image of the Buddha as our object to develop serenity on. Serenity is the word, by the way, for shamatha, the English word I'm using to translate shamatha. Okay, so you visualize the image of the Buddha. So far, so good. There he is. And then pizza. And then your boyfriend, girlfriend. And then everything on your to-do list. Yeah. And, you know, the Buddha is long gone. Yeah. So we very easily forget the object. Yeah. So mindfulness is the mental factor that keeps us on the object. Yeah. So mindfulness is related to memory. It's the same word in Sanskrit and Pali as for memory. So it means that you are able to remember an object that you're familiar with, focus your mind on it in such a way that your mind doesn't go off to other objects. Okay? So mindfulness in Buddhism is not the same meaning as secular mindfulness. Okay, I gave a whole talk about this in Singapore. Is it on the web yet? Yeah, well, it's coming soon. Yeah, just comparing what secular mindfulness and Buddhist mindfulness are, because they're different. Secular mindfulness is just being attentive. It's bare attention to what's going on with you. Yeah. Buddhist mindfulness is having a particular purpose for your meditation. It's not just to calm your mind. You're trying to develop concentration, develop wisdom, develop some virtuous quality. Buddhist mindfulness is done with refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Yeah. It's done with a Dharma motivation. And it remembers a specific object in such a way that our mind can't go off of it. Yeah. Whereas the bare attention that is being called mindfulness and secular mindfulness is simply observing what is coming up in your mind. Yeah. And that in and of itself is neither virtuous nor non-virtuous. It's just observation. It's very helpful to many people, but we have to be clear that that's not what Buddhists mean by mindfulness. Okay? And I think it's good. I've talked with some people who teach secular mindfulness, and we've concluded that it's actually really good to separate the two, yeah? So that people who want to practice secular mindfulness can do so without thinking that they have to have any particular religious beliefs, because they don't. It's a technique that will help them. And Buddhists can practice Buddhist mindfulness, yeah, knowing that it's not just to make their mind peaceful, but it has a real spiritual dimension and purpose to it and will lead to awakening. So actually, Bhava Viveka gave a very nice quote about mindfulness here. So he said, "The elephant of the mind wandering wildly is to be securely bound with the rope of mindfulness to the pillar of a meditative object and is gradually tamed with the hook of mind, of wisdom." Okay? So this is another interesting thing about Buddhist mindfulness, is that it should lead to wisdom. Yeah, and be involved in some way or another with wisdom. Okay, so I say this, you know, because, well, here I'm going off on a tangent, so, you know, I'm uncontrolled. We have a spiritual purpose when we're doing Buddhist mindfulness. Yeah, we're not just observing what's happening. And we're doing our concentration practice based on ethical conduct, because we initially develop mindfulness and this other helpful mental factor called introspective awareness. We initially develop them by practicing ethical conduct, by being aware of our body and speech and holding them, you know, being mindful and holding them to virtuous actions instead of just saying whatever. Yeah. So I've always, when I was thinking about this before my talk in Singapore, and you know, all this talk has come up about sexual harassment in the workplace. And so I was thinking, you know, the people who practice secular mindfulness, which is just bare observation of what my thoughts are, what I'm saying, what I'm doing, in the case of the men, are they applying that kind of mindfulness to how they treat women? Yeah, is there mindfulness of, oh, now maybe I'm stepping beyond what is proper behavior? Maybe I'm going into, you know, sexual harassment. Is there any awareness of that, you know? And I'm wondering, you know, the people who teach secular mindfulness, do they bring this up as a thing to be aware of? Yeah, because we certainly need to be aware of that, don't we? Yeah. I was wondering also, so, you know, I'm speaking about women's issues here, you know, but when people are practicing secular mindfulness, are they aware when they interrupt women in meetings? Are they aware when they talk down to women or when they dismiss women's ideas and opinions? Yeah. I wonder if the people who teach that kind of mindfulness, you know, bring that up as a possible thing to be aware of. Or are they just having people be aware of, you know, I'm inhaling, I'm exhaling, I'm moving my hand, I'm thinking about this or that. Okay? Because I think, you know, if we're really gonna, just even with secular mindfulness, just bare attention, practicing bare attention, it has to be directed also towards some of these really sticky issues. Yeah, am I aware that I have prejudice against certain races and ethnic groups? Am I aware that I automatically dislike someone from another political party? Yeah, I wonder. So any of you who, if you do this secular mindfulness, ask the people who teach you about this. I'm quite curious, yeah? Because I think as a society, we need to be more aware of these kinds of things, yeah? So I just gave a few examples. There's tons of them. So excuse me that I don't talk politics all the evening. Actually, these things are not politics. The things I mentioned, they're common decency. their ethical conduct, aren't they? You know, why have they gotten politicized to start with? Okay. Okay, let me go back to what. Yeah. So, in cultivating mindfulness, silence is very important because when we talk, then our mind is, you know, we're talking about all sorts of different things. So the mind is going all over the place. And then when we sit down to meditate, the mind is reviewing all the discussions that we had in the break time. So this is why in our retreat this weekend, we'll be keeping silence, not because we're unfriendly and cold and rude, but because we're giving each other space to quiet our mind down and, you know, begin to get in touch with what's going on inside of us instead of being so outward directed. Yeah, because when we're outward directed all the time, I mean, we're creatures of habit, then that's where our attention goes. Yeah, beautiful sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and sensations. What we want to do to develop serenity is focus on an inner object, a visualized object, or a meditative object. Yeah. So keeping silence helps us remember that object and helps us quiet the mind down and not be so involved in creating a personality. Yeah. So you know how it is when you go in a place and you meet new people? It's like, hi, this is my name. And this is where I live. This is what I do. These are all my identities. Yeah. And this is what I like, and this is what I don't like, and da, 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 da. And we have our whole identity that we create in telling somebody else this is who I am. And that whole identity, of course, is made up, totally created by the mind, and yet we believe it's real. Yeah. So all this kind of talking just in many ways solidifies that kind of identity. Yeah. So when you come here to the Abbey, we don't really care what your occupation is. Yeah. Sorry, you know, I mean, we really don't care, you know, unless we need something. So, yeah. So if you know how to, if you're a professional dishwasher, you know, or you know how to fix snow blowers, or what else do we need? Run a chainsaw. Run a chainsaw, yeah, especially in the winter. yeah. Drive a truck, yeah.
Fix audio, video, sound systems.
Okay, yeah, so fixing it. Yeah, microphone. Okay, yeah. So those kinds of things. Okay, so if your occupation is fixing microphones, yeah, then we want to know about it. But the rest, you know, it's like you have the freedom to come to the Abbey and be nobody. Yeah, and being nobody gives you so much freedom. We don't care what socioeconomic class you belong to. We don't care whether you're Buddhist or not. We don't care about your ethnic background. We don't care about your political affiliation as long as you agree with us. Which I think most people do. We don't really have to have a checkbox for that on the application form. Yeah. So, you know, you have a lot of freedom here, and you don't have to create a person to present to anybody. Okay. So this kind of silence is conducive to building mindfulness in our meditation. Okay, then the third one is agitation and laxity. Yeah. So those two, even though they're quite opposite, agitation is, you know, you're agitated, you're restless, your mind's going off to an object of desire. Laxity is going close to lethargy and, you know, kind of the opposite. But their antidote is the same, so that's why they're put together as a pair. And their antidote is introspective awareness, which I'll talk about in a minute. Okay, so when we're cultivating single-pointedness, there's two characteristics, yeah? One is stability, yeah? So we want to develop stability or the ability to stay on the meditation object. And the second one is clarity. So clarity is clarity of the subject, the mind that's meditating. Yeah, it's not necessarily clarity of the object, yeah, because it's clarity of the subject brings clarity of the object, okay? So it's the clarity is the mind being vibrant and attentive and alert, okay? So there's two things that interfere with these two. So the chief things that interferes with developing stability is agitation, because agitation and restlessness is going to take you all over the planet. The chief hindrance to developing clarity is laxity, because laxity, you don't have a vibrant, attentive mind. Okay. Now, laxity and agitation both have coarse and subtle forms to them, okay? So coarse, so, and then also there's some other terms here. So there's scattering. Scattering is your mind's just going off to all sorts of objects. You scatter, okay? And some of your scattering may be virtuous, like you're meditating on precious human life, and you start thinking about karma. Yeah, so you're going off the topic, but the topic you're on is something virtuous. So this kind of distraction, it can be virtuous. It can be non-virtuous. You know, you're thinking about someone you can't stand. Or it can be neutral. You're thinking about how you're going to do the laundry after the meditation session. Okay, so that's scattering. Distraction is pretty much the same as scattering. You're distracted. Wandering, mental wandering, yeah, is another translation for distraction. And then there's one of our favorite ones that some people translate it as discursiveness, other people as conceptualization. Lama Yeshe used to call it superstition. Okay, and for him, superstition didn't mean, you know, kind of stepping on cracks and black cats. Superstition meant all of this proliferation of ideas and thoughts and opinions and worries and, you know, anxiety and all that kind of stuff that, you know, just agitates our mind. Yeah, you know that? Yeah, I think so. Yeah. You're sitting here, everything's peaceful, but then what happens if I get a heart attack now? And then you start getting really anxious, you know. I'm going to get, maybe what happens if I get a heart attack when I'm sitting here? Do I fall this way? Do I fall that way? Does anybody here know how to do CPR? Mm-hmm. Oh, Venerable Jigme knows, but she can't get over here very quickly right now. She trained everybody else in the Abbey, but if they're like me, they've forgotten. Yeah. And then, you know, oh, what happened? And then, you know, well, okay, I'm not going to have a heart attack, but my uncle had a heart attack. Then you start worrying about your uncle. You know, so how's Uncle Joe do? Is he, Joe doing? And then your mind, you know, full of worries, anxiety, stuff that hasn't even happened, but it's occupying your mind. Okay? What happens if they ask me to shovel snow? I don't want to shovel snow. What am I going to do when they ask me to shovel snow? I'm going to say no, but I can't say no. That's not polite. So how do I get out of it without saying no? And then you go into this whole conceptualization trip about how to get out of shoveling the snow, yeah, and getting somebody else to do it for you, you know, because your little finger hurts and you can't hold the shovel very well. Okay? So this is superstitious thought. Yeah, we're full of it, aren't we? Yeah. Just the mind manufacturing garbage. Okay. So one type of this superstitious thought is agitation. Yeah. So it's the agitation is sometimes some people translate it as excitement, but I don't like that translation because excitement people often enjoy, whereas agitation is not so pleasant. Some people translate it as restlessness. The mind is restless. It can't stay still. But especially here with agitation, you're going to an object of desire. Yeah. And, you know, when we finally get ourselves seated on the cushion, we finally remember the object we're meditating on and put mindfulness on it. Then what interrupts us is a very coarse form of agitation where our mind goes off to an object of attraction. Okay? So you're thinking about lunch, you're thinking about a person you're attracted to, you're thinking about where you're going to go on vacation, you're thinking about, you know, what you want to go to the store and buy, okay? Mind is going to an object of attachment. With coarse agitation, we've actually left the object we're meditating on, okay? You're at the department store. You're at the beach with your boyfriend, girlfriend, okay? You're somewhere else in your mind, even though your body's here. Subtle agitation is a little bit different. You have some stability on the object, but there's movement under the surface. Okay? So you're on the object, but some agitation is brewing and you're about ready to start daydreaming. Okay? So they say that this kind of subtle agitation is like, you know, there's frozen ice, but underneath it, the water's moving. Okay? So the ice can crack. We'll go off the object of meditation soon. Okay. Then, so the antidote here to agitation, as it's said here, is introspective awareness. Okay. Introspective awareness isn't the actual antidote, but it's what you need in order to notice that either coarse or subtle agitation has arisen in your mind. So introspective awareness, this is the mind, it's a mental factor that monitors our mind, that is aware of what's going on in my mind. Am I still on my meditation object or am I in the coffee shop? Yeah, what am I paying attention to? So we have to monitor the mind and see what's going on with our mind, but not make the introspective awareness so strong that it actually disrupts our comfort concentration. So it's kind of a talent you have to develop. But if we don't have enough introspective awareness, then our mind is in la-la land, you know, for most of the meditation session until you hear this. Yeah? And then, oh, okay. Come back from the beach. Yeah. Okay, so that's agitation. Then laxity. Okay. Oh, I should mention, so the introspective awareness notices that there's agitation. Yeah. Then the actual remedy to the agitation is to renew your mindfulness on the object. Okay. Now, if that doesn't work, you know, because your mind is just so agitated or so restless, then you might need to, instead of trying to continue your meditation focusing, developing concentration on your meditation object, you might have to, for a short time, switch to another meditation that is going to lower your energy. Because when there's agitation, the mind is too much. Yeah? So in that case, what you might reflect on for a few minutes to lower your energy is impermanence and death. Yeah? The faults of cyclic existence. Yeah? So these kinds of things are going to lower the mind and make it easy, lower the energy of the mind and make it easier for you to return to your object of meditation. If that doesn't work, then try just focusing on the breath and see if that would help you overcome the agitation. If that doesn't work, then instead of pushing yourself or criticizing yourself, just conclude your meditation session, take a break, and then come back to your session again, okay? So don't conclude your session the first time you get distracted, okay? You know, because you sit down to meditate, there's the Buddha. Oh, I want to check my cell phone. Oh, she said, end your session, bye-bye. No, you start meditating on impermanence and death, faults of cyclic existence. Yeah, you try meditating on the breath. You work at it a while, you know, to calm your mind down and then return it to the image of the Buddha. Then, if none of that works after a while, then you end your session, but you do not go check your cell phone. Okay? Because that's just going to establish a really bad habit. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, so maybe, you know, if you're getting distracted because of your phone, then you need to do some meditation on the faults of, you know, addiction to devices. Yeah, which is, you know, I don't know. Is that in the... Yeah, is that addiction to devices? It's being considered, huh? Yeah. Because there's rehab centers, I heard, in Korea for young people who have that addiction problem. Okay, then laxity. Yeah. So there's laxity and then there's lethargy. Yeah. Here the actual fault is laxity. But before we talk about that, we have to talk about lethargy. So lethargy is very close to sleepiness. Okay. Your body and mind are heavy. You're fading into oblivion. Yeah, you know that feeling? Yeah, you're dull. And it usually happens when you're sitting in the front row and everybody can see you. Yeah. You know that one? Yeah? Okay, it always happens to me when I'm in the front row, you know, people are looking, you're supposed to be a good example. And this kind of lethargy, it's or sleepiness, it's not from, it's usually not from having enough sleep. When you're jet lagged, it is from having enough sleep. But often it's some kind of karmic obscuration because of negativity, negative karma that we've created in the previous lifetimes, such that we sit down to meditate. We're wide awake before, and boing, we're out, yeah? So it's good to do some purification if that afflicts you. Okay, so even though the hindrance mentioned here, the fault mentioned here is laxity, lethargy is implied. Okay, and lethargy isn't mentioned as one of the five faults by itself because on higher levels of concentration, it doesn't happen very often. Yeah, lethargy happens on initial levels, you know. But it can hang on for a while, okay? I ask sometime, you know, whether anybody has ever fallen over from falling asleep. And one of my Dharma friends told me once that he did actually fall over when Lama Zopa Rinpoche was teaching. Of course, this was at, what, 2 or 3 in the morning. We can forgive him. yeah, but he clunk. And I think that woke everybody else up. So, okay. So then there's laxity, okay? So there's coarse laxity. So when that is present, there is some stability on the object. So you still have stability, but the clarity has decreased. Okay, so the if you don't handle it, then you start to actually lose the object in that the object doesn't appear so clearly. So the mind begins to become foggy, and because of that, the object, you know, is foggy. The mind isn't actually drowsy with coarse lethargy, but it just lacks force. It lacks energy. If we're not careful, it'll go into lethargy. Okay, but it's and it's sometimes it's said to be kind of a vague, agreeable sensation. Yeah, so like being spaced out. Yeah, yeah. There's different levels of spaced outedness. So I think coarse lethargy is one. Okay, so because the mind has become too withdrawn inside, with coarse laxity, when because the mind's too withdrawn inside, the antidote is to enlarge the scope of the object. So if you're visualizing the Buddha, make the image brighter, make it a little bit larger. Do some analytical meditation and go over the details of the image of the Buddha. Okay. If coarse laxity persists and doing that doesn't work, then visualize like a bright light or, you know, turn on the light in your room. Things that can lead to this kind of stuff is, and it depends. Some people like to meditate in the dark. Some people like to meditate in the light. So if you're in the dark, it usually counteracts agitation. If you're in the light, it counteracts laxity and lethargy. So it depends, you know, what kind of person you are. But if you have laxity, then you want to, visualize light. Maybe do the breathing meditation, inhale light and think that your whole body mind is filled with it, exhale darkness, yeah, that kind of thing will help. Or if that doesn't help, then meditate on something that will raise the energy of your mind, something that will gladden your mind. So like precious human life, the qualities of the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, Buddha nature, you know, some of the bodhicitta, the benefits of bodhicitta, these kinds of things, because doing a little bit of reflection or analytical meditation on those things makes the mind brighter, and then it dispels the coarse laxity. Subtle laxity is much harder to notice, and it doesn't appear until after you've developed some stability. You don't have to worry about subtle laxity at the beginning because you're just trying to stay awake. But it, you know, in the nine stages of sustained attention, it's going to come later, around the fifth or sixth stage. Okay? So subtle laxity is, they say it's the worst fault when you're trying to generate concentration, because it's very difficult to notice. So you have stability, you have clarity, but the mind is not so vibrant. So it's hard to notice it because you're on the object and there's some clarity on the object and your mind feels quite pleasant. Yeah. So they say, you know, that because it's so difficult to recognize, some people don't recognize subtle laxity. They stay meditating in subtle laxity, actually thinking that they've developed serenity when they haven't. And so because of that, then they don't make any effort really to improve their meditation because they think they've already attained serenity. So it's very, you know, pernicious in that regard. So there's many disadvantages to this subtle kind of laxity. It's similar to samadhi in that you have stability and clarity, but it's not going to take you to serenity. And they say that if you continue to meditate with subtle laxity, then in your next life you could be reborn as somebody who's very stupid, you know, that because it makes your mind rather dull and stupid after a while. Okay, they say another thing that makes it hard to identify is that the meditator's breath may even stop. Yeah, because they are so concentrated. So it may look like they have deep meditation, but again, they don't. Okay, so it's something really to be attentive to. Okay. So again, introspective awareness is said to be the antidote, because this mental factor that monitors the mind, you know, it'll see whether you have coarse or subtle education, coarse or subtle laxity, okay, if you fall into lethargy, and then you have to apply the individual antidote for either agitation or laxity. Then the fourth fault in concentration is non-application. So you're on the seat, you remember that your meditation object, you have some introspective awareness, and you've noticed that there's agitation or you've noticed that there's laxity, and then you don't do anything about it. Yeah. Have you ever been daydreaming in your meditation? And it you notice you're daydreaming, but it's such a nice daydream that you don't really want to stop. Okay? So it's like that. You're not applying the antidote to it. Yeah. Or you're falling asleep, and you know you're falling asleep, but you don't do anything. Okay? So the remedy for this one, well, first of all, they say that this is the fourth fault. So they say that this is similar to a spy finding out that the enemy is lurking, but then the general doesn't send out the troops to do anything about it. Yeah. Or they say it's like, you know, somebody's coming into your house, but you don't, as a thief, and you know something's going on, but you just don't do anything, and they, you know, they burglarize your house. Okay, so, yeah, so here the antidote is applying the antidote, yeah. And so again, there requires some finesse in this process, because with agitation, the mode of apprehending the object is too tight, so that's why the mind gets agitated. With laxity, the mode of holding the object is too loose, so the mind gets lax. So it's this thing of learning how tightly to focus on the object. You know, if you're too tight, it's like tuning a guitar string. If it's too tight, you're go sharp, right? Mm-hmm. And if it's too loose, you go flat. So you have to kind of get the right thing, and it's going to take some trial and error to do that. Okay, and then the last fault is over-application of the antidote, and its remedy, as I said, is chilling out, aka equanimity. So equanimity here it means chilling out. You know, if you're you're constantly applying the antidote. It's kind of like, you know, you have a child and your child's behaving, but you keep telling your child to stay still and behave well. And they're already doing it. So you keep, by keeping telling the child to do that, you disturb the child. Okay? So in the same way, if we've applied the antidote, we're meditating fine, but then we continue to apply the antidote, it's only going to disturb our concentration. So that's why we have to learn to remain equanimous. Those are the five faults and the eight antidotes as taught by Maitreya. So, questions, comments?
I was curious if you could elaborate a little bit on the distinguishing between mindfulness and introspective awareness. Mm. As it seems like it would be easy to confuse the two. Mm. And so the way I understood you describe it is like introspective awareness is kind of like the guard that alerts your mind that it's gone off. But maybe the mindfulness is the one that pulls it back to the object and keeps it there. But could you just, is that accurate, or could you give another better analogy?
Okay. So mindfulness and introspective alertness often come together. You know, they're spoken about together. But mindfulness is what actually keeps your mind on the object. Okay. Introspective awareness is like a spy, and it checks, are you on the object or are you somewhere else? So they work together, yeah, but they have slightly different functions, because The introspective awareness is it's monitoring. It's like the spy. But the mindfulness is, you know, that's what actually creates the stability. Okay.
In a follow-up, are there different ways to develop introspective awareness versus mindfulness, or is it, yeah?
Yeah. Well, I think both of them are require just practice. Yeah. They come, both mindfulness and introspective awareness come in ethical conduct. So in that, and by practicing ethical conduct, you know, that helps you develop them. But in ethical conduct, for example, the role of mindfulness would be to remember your precepts, remember your values, remember how you want to be in the world. And then introspective awareness is paying attention to what you're doing. And am I living according to my own values and precepts and so on? Okay, so they come together in that way in our daily life behavior. In our meditation, it's we're focusing on the object and then we supervise. And so it's just a matter of practicing them, yeah? It's like, I don't know how to describe specific ways to develop them, except, yeah, keep bringing your mind back to the object and placing it on the object, yeah. Although, you know, when we renew our mindfulness, I think it is helpful at the beginning of the session to say to ourselves, this is my meditation object. This is what I'm going to focus on. I'm not going to let my mind wander over the universe. And so creating a strong intention at the beginning, I think, can help make our mindfulness stronger.
So I just want to clarify. So the mindfulness is keeping our mind on the object, and the introspective awareness is an awareness of whether we're doing that or not.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
I was wondering if you could comment on yoga meditation or walking meditation, kind of comparing and contrasting it to just sitting meditation. Mm-hmm. And the reason I ask is I find I'm able to concentrate so much better with movement involved. Mm-hmm. And secondly, I sit all day at my work in front of the computer, very concentrated, and it's a lame excuse, but it's sometimes easier to have movement with meditation.
What is yoga meditation?
Just concentrated yoga practice, I guess, is how it's been explained to me.
So you're doing yoga and different asanas and just paying attention while you're doing those?
Yes.
Yeah. So that is... I think doing yoga is very, very helpful to developing serenity or doing analytic meditation or anything like that. But I wouldn't call that actually meditation, okay? I would say that, paying attention while you're doing yoga would be increasing your introspective awareness, because you, when you're doing the asanas, you have to be aware of, you know, I got my leg around my head and, you know, whatever it is. Okay, I look like a pretzel. I'm joking, but, so you have to be aware of what you're doing. So it helps you keep with the activity you're doing, but I wouldn't call that mindfulness or meditation, okay? And with walking meditation, in some ways it's kind of similar. There's usually instructions on what exactly to focus on when you're walking. So you may be focusing on the movement of your feet. You may be focusing on the image of yourself as a deity. You may be focusing on cultivating love and compassion for all the beings around you. So that's something that's going to require some mindfulness and some introspective awareness to make sure your mind's on the object. But, and we call it meditation, but I don't think just doing that is going to lead you to serenity. That is usually practiced as something to do in the break time before, when you're in retreat, between your sitting sessions. Okay? But certainly, if you sit all day, yeah, because I sit a lot every day too, and I like to walk, then, and I find the walking quite relaxing after sitting all day, then, you know, keeping, again, having an object that you try and stay focused on, keeping your mind on that object is certainly going to help you when you actually sit down and do concentration meditation.
When you mentioned the difference between having a lax mind, thinking that you have achieved serenity, a relaxed mind.
Okay.
And you are confused and you think that you have achieved serenity.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I might have been doing that all my life. I mean, since I started meditating. So what would be the subtle point? Because I think that my mind is laxed or relaxed and I'm equanimous, but maybe I am just,
You need a relaxed mind to meditate. An uptight mind is going to have a really difficult time staying on the object. So your mind needs to be relaxed, but relaxed doesn't mean inattentive and spaced out. Okay? We usually think, when we hear relax, of, you know? But here in meditation, we want a relaxed body that's sitting firmly in our meditation position. We want a relaxed mind that's firmly on the object of meditation.
So if the mind is, it is calm,
mm-hmm.
Say I don't have a specific focus of meditation, a specific object of meditation, I'm just kind of in one wave,
yeah.
Would that be not? It's
good to have an object of meditation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because if you don't really have an object that you're focusing on, then it's easy for your mind just to slip into who knows what. Okay? So meditation isn't just a thing of eliminating all the thoughts and being in some kind of nebulous, non-conceptual state.
So, as we look at mindfulness as it's become more mainstream,
uh-huh.
We look at it in the areas of prison or schools, and this is a secular mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
One of the products or byproducts of that experience has been pacifying gross emotions, you know, very afflictive states of mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I was struggling with was, as I look at that, I associate that is a virtuous experience, because those people aren't acting out of gross anger or gross sexual attraction or hostility in those ways, but they're able to create a more realistic sense of reality,
mm-hmm.
just by observing the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so to come back to the question that you posited, where, you know, do people who sexually assault or sexually harass, does mindfulness become an extension of their behavior and they reify it? Does mindfulness, even from a secular perspective, have the ability to pacify coarse or gross emotions?
Yeah. So I think whether secular mindfulness, can pacify gross emotions and chill people out in that way is going to depend on how they are instructed. Yeah. If they're just instructed to pay attention and that's it, then it may or may not. Okay? Because somebody may get angry, and I'm aware that I'm angry, and I'm aware this person hit me, and, you know. So that's why I think that it's so important to have an element, two elements, one of ethical conduct and the other of compassion, being taught together with secular mindfulness. It needs a context. Yeah? So if you teach it with, you know, an underpinning of ethical conduct and, you know, okay, when you're sitting, you do mindfulness, but when you're walking around, you keep good ethical conduct. Yeah? Then it gives the person some awareness to discriminate between virtue and non-virtue. Otherwise, you know, people have, they go off on some daydream and it's so fantastic. But they know they're on a daydream and then, you know, develop rationalization for it. Okay? So I think how things are taught, the context is so important. Yeah.
It's reminded me of something I wanted to ask you about. Jeffrey has us reading Walking Through Walls a little bit. Mm-hmm. So I've been reading that some, and I had never heard this before, but it made sense to me. I wondered if you knew about it. He was talking about how, say, with breathing meditation, which I think is also taught in secular mindfulness, but anyone doing breathing meditation, he says, the Geshe says, it's actually not an antidote. It suppresses, like, any afflictions, all afflictions, but you actually haven't had an antidote because you haven't done something opposite to the affliction. Mm-hmm. So he made this distinction that I thought was interesting because it was kind of like, I could see how that would really be the case. You could, you know, get your mind peaceful and calm, but you've actually never addressed addressed your hatred or addressed your lust or anything with something that is the total opposite mm-hmm. of it. So he said mm-hmm. it really wasn't an antidote. It was just a gross kind of suppression. It would be, you know, in the sense of meditative suppression, not psychological.
Yeah.
It was interesting. I hadn't ever heard that before.
Yeah.
It seems like it kind of addresses that a little bit too, because you're not really, there's no ethics, you know, there's no analytic thought about what you're doing. You're just like,
well, again, there's different kinds of breathing meditation.
Yeah. It's like bare attention is what I was.
Okay,
like,
you know, you mean just bare attention to the breath.
Yeah.
See, that's because the Tibetans, when they think of breathing meditation, they think of something that you do for about 5 or 10 minutes before you do your actual session. Yeah? So I think he's saying it in that context. They don't usually think of breathing meditation as part of establishing mindfulness on the body. But that is interesting that, yes, it calms the mind, but it doesn't directly oppose what distraction there was.
So I had a question concerning this also, is that I've heard two different things that define whether something is dharma or not.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those was whether it's addressing the afflictions. The other would be when you look at the three motivations of the mm-hmm. of the Lama Rinpoche, and the fourth motivation that's not dharma, which is a motivation just for the pleasure of this life.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are addressing the afflictions, but you don't have a worldview or a motivation that goes beyond this life, is that really dharma? Or is that first definition a little bit too inclusive?
Yeah. Yeah, Geshe Dado Namgyal and I talked about this a lot. And what we came up with was that the what they say is the actual demarcation between Dharma and non-Dharma is whether they're it's tricky because they usually say it's whether the motivation is only for the happiness of this life, implying that you should have aspire for future life, good future rebirth, or for liberation, or for awakening. Yeah. So, but then that leaves the question, what about people who aren't Buddhist, who don't have those kinds of motivations? Are they creating virtue? Yes, when they're counteracting the afflictions, definitely they're creating virtue. Okay? So it seems like the demarcation of creating virtue is different than the demarcation of Dharma and non-Dharma.
I just wondered if you could tell me a little bit more about switching from that busyness to low energy, which you were saying might be impermanence or death.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I suppose if I was walking on the beach with a boyfriend and I'd go, you know, in my mind, and then I go, oh, I'll switch to death. I don't know if I'd want to. But how those are low energy switches.
Okay. It doesn't mean necessarily low energy. It means making the mind more sober.
So if you're in this excited state, you're just kind of
bringing
that energy level down.
Right. Okay. Because when we have attachment in the mind gets restless, it gets giddy, and you can't focus. So it's making the mind sober. And reflecting on impermanence and death makes our mind sober, doesn't it? Yeah. Okay. So we'll stop here for today. And then next week we'll do the 9 stages of sustained attention.